You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Front One.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, September 27, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, to help me feel pity for the billionaires, Thomas Frank, coincidentally author of Pity the Billionaire, now out in paperback, will be joining us. Also on the program today, Greeks and Spaniards, they don't pity the billionaires. They have been protesting, it feels like over the weekend, but I guess I was just out for a day or two for the holiday. Because of the next round of austerity being imposed upon them by the bankers. Also on the program today, Donald Trump squeezing gas out and offending people in New York. I can't help myself, folks. Interesting story about how the government is approaching WikiLeaks, revealed by a new Freedom of Information Act. Also on the program today, Sheldon Adelson making a sort of a stunning admission about why he's supporting Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney, another tape has come out now. Sort of lends credence, I guess, as if you needed it, to the argument that Bain really wasn't so much about creating jobs. And a couple more pieces of note online asking whether or not it's moral to vote for Obama, particularly after the release of a new report on our drone strike program in Pakistan and the implications it's having for people who live around there. We'll talk about that more as the program goes on. It appears, I don't know if they have now settled the NFL strike. The lockout, I should say. Not the strike. The lockout of the refs. Very important distinction. Apparently, according to Dave Zirin, now understand how ridiculous this lockout is. And we may get into it. We may have Dave Zirin on the program next week, so I'm not going to go too deep into this because I would rather him talk about it. But for a moment, contemplate the idea, because what's relevant here is that, you know, it actually does make a difference to have experienced people do these jobs. And I have no doubt that there are bad refs in the NFL. And they have procedures to pull them out. But can anybody come up with the sort of the quantitative way you would determine whether or not a ref is bad? In other words, I just want to sort of draw an analogy to teachers. Would it be how well the players are functioning? I mean, I guess it's not the exact same thing, but I don't know. It's just one more example of of people trying to bust a union. Maybe that's where the analogy ends, but and they did it in this case by locking them out and actually debilitating their product. It just there's a certain delusion, I think, that well, billionaires who own these football teams, millionaires have, and we will talk more about that with Thomas Frank in a moment. I guess I am back from Yom Kippur. I'm still suffering from the fasting, I think, and have yet to. I don't know how I got so rusty in just 24 hours. All right, we got to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Thomas Frank. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to this program Thomas Frank, author of Pity the Billionaire, out now in paperback. Of course, also author of The Wrecking Crew and What's the Matter with Kansas. Also, I believe, are available in paperback. Is that right?
That is correct, Sam.
Thomas, welcome.
Not just paperback. Some of them are available in foreign languages.
Oh, well, there you go. We have many people who listen to the program from outside the U.S. I assume they speak English or they just love the sound of my voice. And I actually, there was a guy I went 2 days ago. I was out eating dinner with my daughter in a cafe, guy reading The Wrecking Crew, sitting right next to us.
Really? Yep. You know, I've never seen that. You must live in an area with a lot of liberals or something.
Indeed. Yes, I do.
I'm always worried whenever I carry a book that I wrote. You know, I'm always worried when I carry it in a public place.
That someone's going to beat you up?
Yeah, someone's going to. Look at that liberal.
There you go. Looking around. You're just going to keep it under your wraps that you're actually the author.
Yeah.
Then it becomes even more of a problem.
Yeah.
Well,
I do see people all the time reading Ayn Rand in public places these days.
I know. But you know what? People, I think a lot of people do it ironically.
Yeah. No, I don't think so, Sam. It's like, you know, Atlas Shrugged, it's 1,000 pages. That's a lot of weight for irony.
I don't know. I think it's actually sort of like the way that people will wear sort of like you know, I'm thinking of like those blue chiffon tuxes with the, but it is a problem. I mean, actually that is a perfect segue, Thomas, into one of the things I wanted to talk to you about, because it is, you know, we're now getting closer to the election. You know, I see more and more pieces basically saying that this thing, there's just not that many undecided voters left. We're in a time of unparalleled polarization. And I think back to the What's the Matter with Kansas? And I think it's fair to say that one of the main arguments that you were making to the aside from an analysis was that Democrats need to get back to populism to sort of wean these sort of Reagan Democrat style or former populists from relying too heavily or being triggered by cultural war issues.
Well, the larger argument, Sam, is, I mean, if you look at the way, you know, at what's been happening with income distribution in this country, or, you know, the fate of wage earners in this country over the last 30 years, if you just look at it on paper, everything indicates, oh, well, you must be in a period where the left is really, you know, like everybody is signing up for it and they're going from victory to victory and it's like this huge mass movement. I mean, that's what it seems like. If you, it would be really easy to build a party of, you know, of the left in this country right now that had no trouble winning every election. I mean, when the economy is doing, you know, is sorting people out, this, you know, is doing these things to people in this, on this gigantic scale, it really should not be hard. And yet the exact opposite is the case. The culture wars was one reason for that. That's sort of dropped off this year though.
But I guess the thing that fascinates me, I mean, let's put aside for a moment the failure of the, and I don't know if failure is really even the right word, because that implies an attempt of the Democrats to essentially carry this economic populist torch. Let's put that aside for a moment. It seems to me that when we, you know, that free market capitalism or whatever they want to call it, that economics wise, that this is also now become part of the culture war, that we're just using the language of economics, but basically still talking about the same divide that exists in society.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. I mean, we seem to talk about economics all the time. That's what everybody's saying. Oh, well, this election is about that, not about this other thing, not about these culture wars that you've been fighting for 30 years. But when they say that, if you look at the way that we actually describe economics, it's in these highly moralistic terms. I mean, Mitt Romney and the 47% that he hates, right? The takers, the moochers. This is not a serious economic discussion. None of this stuff is. When we talk about deficits, it's always in, moral terms, terms of your, you know, personal, you know, a family wouldn't be allowed to do something like this, so neither should the government. We never talk about these things in a straightforward way.
It was, I mean, you know, I was just listening again to that 47% tape, because it's, you know, it's all over the place and there's so many different aspects of it that it was almost sort of too much to cover in some way. But, you know, as he's describing this 47%, he says, like, you know, these people think that they're entitled to food and health care. I don't know what else he said. And he just said, what was it? He said food and health care.
Yeah. But it's like, yeah, that's right. They're born in the modern world.
Right. I mean,
you know, they are. Guess what? They are entitled to those things.
Housing and all these sorts of things, he said. He said something like that, like et cetera, as if these things were like, you know, like they feel like they're entitled to air. And to just go around and breathe wherever they want. I mean, it is stunning.
It's,
I mean,
so
this
bitter.
Is...
And I mean, but it, I don't know where we're going here. Are we going back to Ayn Rand? You know, this sense that people have, you know, what's funny is that the populism is all on the other side, okay? The side of Mitt and company, you know, denouncing average people who think they're entitled to, you know, to being able to make a living, you know, to call them parasites. You know, rather than average citizens and workers and stuff like that. That's where the populist fire is. It's all with these Ayn Rand. Remember how all of this stuff got started? What was his name on the floor of the Chicago Board of Trade? Rick Santelli.
Right.
You know, the people who carry the water versus the people who just want to drink the water. You know, and he, by the way, another big Ayn Rand fan. But the whole idea there being that traders, the traders who were surrounding him on the floor of the Chicago Board of Trade, that these guys were producers, and everybody else, meaning like the workers who actually, you know, build everything in this country, that those people are just parasites. You know, they just want a handout. They just want government to give them everything.
That Santelli rant is a stunning moment that people should really go back and take a look at, because he is literally like it's an angry mob, but an angry mob of commodity traders.
Yeah,
and he's going
who
here wants to pay for anybody else's mortgage? And all these commodity traders go, no, no,
No way! No way!
As if it was like in the town square, and, you know, and all these farmers and peasants are there with the pitchforks. But no, it's actually just these commodity traders.
It's commodity traders, and the irony of it. I mean, the irony of it is that those were the people who, if you go back and look at the original populist movement in the 1890s, those were the enemy. The commodity traders, they were the worst people in the world. These were the definition of parasite. You know, they're the ones that ripped off the farmers and ripped off the consumers at the same time while producing nothing. You know, just gaming the system, doing nothing. Just moving, you know, prices this way and that. Getting a corner in this or that, you know, some kind of monopoly position. And that's who speaks for what was Santelli's term. That was the silent majority. That was those were real Americans. You know, I remember now at the time, everybody was saying, well, there's no way Santelli came up with that. It had to have been like scripted or something or planned or something like that. And I can see how that would make sense to a lot of people because it's such an inversion of the classic populist formula that it feels like it must have been planned. The whole thing, you know, the whole Glenn Beck's, you know, all of the sort of right-wing culture of the last few years, it sometimes feel like it was all done according to plan, the Koch brothers or something. But, of course, that's not the case. It just happened this way.
Right. I mean, the Tea Party came out of the
I mean, no, that, that, okay, that part was
well, no,
largely
I mean,
planned.
Ron, you know, Ron Paul's supporters started this Tea Party. I mean, that's the way they would refer to it. And it was sort of just bastardized and sort of adopted by a lot of the big money on the right.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
But this circles back to this is the point that I wanted to get to, was that what is the prescription for the problem of economics now becoming part of the culture war, rather than supposedly, you know, sort of an agreed upon goal that economics is supposed to solve.
Yeah, or something that you actually discuss with reference to facts.
Right,
okay?
Right. I mean, it's no longer empirical. It is really just more of part of a tribal identification. You know, and I have a lot of sort of so-called libertarians call into this program, and who will say things to me like, you know, I agree with Rick Perry that we should cut three of government agencies. I would start with the Chamber of Commerce.
Yeah,
and like literally, like, you have no idea what you're talking about, but it's all just part of a tribal identity. What happens when economic populism, the way that it's supposed to work, becomes problematic just because it's associated with, I don't know, the hippies or the black people?
Yeah, or people like you and me.
Yes.
You know, the funny thing is that sort of traditional left-wing economic populism, what I don't get is where did that – well, I do get it. I was about to say, where did that stuff go? You know, what happened to it? That was the stuff – that's always been the thing that carried real political power in this country. And yes, it did tend to understand economics in a kind of moral sense, but it was also a sense, you know, it appeals to, you know, vast numbers of working people. It's second nature. Where is it? You know, that's the crazy thing is that, I mean, and I just can't say this enough, we've been living through all of these decades of fake populism, upside down populism, conscious efforts to invert the formulas of the left. You know, going back to Nixon, going back to you know, Spiro Agnew and Barry Goldwater and George Wallace and all this kind of thing, you know, on and on and on and on and on. When is when does the real populism get a turn? I mean, I know Barack Obama is using it to assert sort of in a modified way, to a limited extent, you know, but he has to because of course he's running against Mitt Romney. You know, he's running against one of the richest guys in America, or a very wealthy man. But it's just so deeply frustrating to me to watch this happen again and again and again, and see the debate just get hijacked and dragged farther and farther away. You know, when I wrote What's the Matter with Kansas, which was about this kind of fake populism in 2004, it seemed inconceivable to me that things could get a whole lot worse.
Right.
You know, politically, and yet It has happened. It has come to pass.
You had what we know now is it was a failure of imagination. Right?
I mean, yeah.
That's the classic sort of Bushism. You just couldn't realize how bad it could get, I guess.
Yeah, but the right could push the country off the economic cliff, you know, and that we the response of the people out in the country is to demand more of this stuff, to want to double down on this philosophy is really striking and
but is this a function? I mean, is this a function? When you say you're frustrated by the lack of this argument being made, I mean, doesn't that imply that it is that the Democrats just can't come to it? I mean, I think from 2004, my sense of why we don't hear this from the Democrats has less to do with they're not able to get their message together. But more that when there is no thing the Democrats.
Yeah.
It is made up of individuals and factions and whatnot. And the faction that is more interested in no populism tends to have control over that message.
Oh, absolutely. And your listeners might not know this, but that faction, I live here in Washington, D.C., and or in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., and if you read the local media, that faction has, decidedly the upper hand in any kind of dispute that you want to read about here. And there are Democrats that, constantly warn against populism. In their mind, what they call populism is the worst possible thing. You've got to avoid it at all costs. Democrats cannot go down that road. It's mortal sin kind of thing. It's unthinkable terrain.
Well, I mean,
these people have the you hear from them constantly. That's who runs the Democratic Party.
I mean, and do they frame it in the context of we can't go down there because of what it will do to society, or we can't go down that road because it's just not electorally feasible?
Yeah, interestingly enough, that's the latter. They usually say because that way lies disaster. We can never win an election if we do that. And but there's evidence for that. I mean, it is really hilarious because there's actually a sort of subset of political science that debates this, that takes this debate seriously,
right.
Debates back and forth. Can a populist appeal win? Can it not win? It's like, dude, it's been winning for the right for 30 years. They win all the time doing this. It happens constantly. In fact, this is the only reason, in my view, or one of the only reasons, that Mitt Romney is doing so poorly is that he can't turn on the populist vibe. He's like from a populist perspective, he's like the worst candidate ever. Obama is not very good at it. Obama is not much of a populist, but compared to Mitt Romney, he's like the guy down at the local feed store or something out in the small town of Kansas,
Well, Romney, having a campaign about economic populism with Romney is like a guy basically losing to a backboard as he's playing tennis. I mean, he's just hitting the ball and he cannot return a single serve. But the thing that gets lost in this is that, and people, I think, have forgot about this much too quickly, in my estimation, is when the Obama campaign followed the lead initially of Newt Gingrich, who really was the one who opened
up his
door in vulture capitalism in that 30-minute film about Bain Capital.
That really put a dent in Romney, and everybody could see at the time. I believe I even wrote about this at the time. That's clearly the way the attack is going to come down on Romney, what's really funny is that he and his advisors seem to be so surprised when the Obama people started busting that on them. It was so unfair.
But you'll recall that in the first couple of days that came out, and it didn't matter what cable station you watched. I mean, MSNBC, I don't think there was a moment where there wasn't some guy coming on, Ed Rendell, Cory Booker, Bill Clinton, whatever.
Yeah, that's right.
Harold Ford saying this is a huge mistake.
Well,
we're not going to go anywhere.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, but that's the point. I mean, they were taking what you said there. That sort of they were couching it in the argument that this is not going to work electorally. And that's falling down the memory hole.
Yeah, that's right. Well, of course, but this happens all the time. That's the people I'm talking about. That's the ones who say, you know, constantly saying you can't do this. The reason they say that is because of, you know, obviously they don't want to do that. That's not the direction they want the Democratic Party to go in. They're not comfortable with that. You live here in D.C. long enough, and what you start to understand what the Democratic Party is about. You know, it's not the party of Roosevelt and Truman and all that sort of thing. It's the party of the post-industrialism of information age capitalism. You know, the idea that's what they have their eye on. They want to be the party of professionals. You know, they have to do that stuff to win elections. They all know it. You know, they have to, you know, obviously organized labor has to turn out for them in this huge way and be really dedicated and drive people to the polls and turn out their members, do all that kind of thing. But that's not who they imagine themselves representing. That's not what they want to be. I mean, there's a reason that these people who are arguably the most important member of their coalition, there's a reason that organized labor never gets what it wants from the Democratic Party.
And so what is the proper response to that? Assuming that there is a response, I mean, I don't know. Answer that for me. And then
for one thing, they got to remember that the faction of the Democratic Party that I'm describing is really well entrenched here in Washington, and it's really well entrenched for the same reason that all of the Koch brothers projects are well entrenched in the Republican Party, because that's what the money wants. You know, that's how money sees itself working, and you know, it's as well entrenched as American Enterprise Institute, Cato Institute. You know, you just go down the list. It's all the same thing. It's the logic of DC. The way you beat them is not with, you know, rational argument. It's by setting up counter institutions, and it's with the way the left wins is by you know, with social movements. You know, that's how things get done. You know, what's funny, Sam? If you go back, I sort of thought, and I'm going to change the subject very slightly on you here, but I sort of thought when President Obama took office that he would be forced by circumstance to do the sort of you know, to be a Franklin Roosevelt style president. You know, that the situation, the economic situation, was so dire that, you know, if he wanted to do something about unemployment, he'd have to do something like a WPA. He'd have to do some kind of federal, you know, hiring program. If he wanted to do something about Wall Street, he'd have to get serious with these guys. He'd have to get tough with them and re-regulate them. He'd have to break up the banks in the manner of the 1930s, like Glass-Steagall Act. You know, he'd have to do all of these things differently. And what's funny is he never did. You know, the situation did not force him to do that. You know, he was able to avoid those things, to sort of continue down the new Democrat path. And here we are.
Well, let me ask
you. He's going to squeak by.
Did you think? Well, I don't think he's going to squeak by, actually.
It's going to be a triumph.
Romney
is certainly sinking fast, isn't he?
Oh yeah. I mean, and I think there was a certain inevitability of it, and it actually sort of reinforces your point. You're anticipating that he was going to have to do this, but did you think that when you say he was going to be forced by circumstance, did you think that the social pressure at the moment would force him to take these actions, or did you think that from a political expediency perspective, if there is a difference between those two things?
Not either one of them. I thought he'd have to do it if he cared. You know, if he really cared about unemployment, he'd have to do it. If he really cared about, you know, about Wall Street, about getting Wall Street under control. You know, these people have learned nothing from the disaster, or very, very little from the disaster. And it's just a matter of time until we have another bubble and another, you know, series of poisoned, investment products out there. It's all going to happen again. And I assumed that the president would want to do something about that. Now, the fact is, all the president really answers to is the need to get reelected, you know, 50% plus one. And I guess they made some calculation at some point that you don't need to deal with these things. You can win without that, and which is really a depressing thought.
It is an incredibly depressing thought, and I thought that at the very least, I mean, I never thought that Mitt Romney could win because he had this sort of tremendous glass jaw in the
Bain Capital thing.
Yes, and just his whole. I don't know what cartoon character you could put up in this context. Like I say, this is like a guy playing tennis against the backboard and losing, because that backboard is just too real. But I thought he would at least give it a better go, and we could actually see President Obama have to really take on those
schemes that
Newt Gingrich had to raise.
That's right. That's right. All that money, you know, all these stories that people are writing, myself included, about all the super PACs and all the money that was pouring into them and still is. You expect that with that kind of money from these captains of industry and these very wealthy people who have, after all, have played the political game very well over the years, you'd think there'd be a little more creativity from these guys. You know, they're just what they're doing is so boring. There's nothing interesting out there. Nothing innovative. But I mean, we aren't done yet by any means. You know, there's still time for somebody to do something clever, but we sure ain't seen it yet.
Now I have to disagree. I'm convinced that all this money is really just sort of, there's a cottage industry on both sides. It's even bigger on the right, and maybe cottage industry is the wrong word, but this is just separating rich people from their money. And having gone through, I think, five incarnations of Air America, I have seen how this operates. With five different ownerships, where you can credit people with a lot of money for having a lot more creativity. Sheldon Adelson, there's an amazing interview with him, I guess, in Politico, where he basically says, "Oh yeah, I mean, I'm pouring this money into Romney because I think the Obama administration Department of Justice is out to get me." And so I'm going to throw $100 million at this problem. And it's probably exactly what the Department of Justice is looking into, you know, his dealings in China, where he probably basically said, we got some gangsters, we got some public officials. I'm going to throw $100 million at them and the problem will go away. Yeah. And that's what he's assuming here. Well, let me ask you this, though.
Usually these are bottom line guys that don't stand for, that don't stand for wasted money and don't stand for stuff like that in their private lives, in their businesses. It's funny that they would, and Mitt Romney himself. I mean, this is a bottom line guy. This is a corporate leveraged buyout kind of guy. How can he run such a crappy campaign?
Well, you bring in the consultants and they make up the metrics. Like, we're here. Look at this Rasmussen poll. This is when we start to close it. And by the time that money is spent, game over. They've already left town. I mean, that's basically what it is. Well, let me ask you this. I don't know if you saw this Connor Friesdorf piece, a writer with The Atlantic, who is basically, he's a libertarian. But I've seen some people on the left also, and this has been an ongoing conversation on this program for the past, I don't know how many months. But things like President Obama's civil liberties record, things like President Obama's drone war record, whistleblowers, a whole raft of issues that it is.
That stuff just makes me so mad.
Well,
of lost opportunities, right? Why doesn't Mitt Romney reach out to people like you and me who are so angry at Obama about that stuff? Why doesn't he reach out and try to make an appeal getting to the left of Obama on those issues, or at least being a libertarian on those issues? Just in terms of creative politicking, it would sure make the race interesting, wouldn't it?
It would force the American public to deal with these issues. The argument is that from Connor Friesdorf is that I could never ever pull a lever for Obama, morally speaking. Where are you in this on this spectrum in terms of the lesser of two evils? Does it make sense? Are you in some way supporting or advocating these policies, both on the economic side and on the civil liberties and foreign policy side?
Well, I am going to probably almost certainly vote for Obama. Not because I'm like really happy with his presidency, but because I'm really worried about what happens if the if Mitt Romney and company take over. And Romney has, you know, the really funny thing is Romney as governor of Massachusetts, you know, make that Mitt Romney into president of the United States, and I'm not too worried about it. You know, there's nothing frightening about that. The frightening thing is all the signals that he's given that he intends to govern, you know, from the right, from the sort of Paul Ryan wing of the party, and that's terrifying. What they would do to the welfare state, you know, that stuff frightens me. And there's no reason to think that the civil liberties questions are even in play. I mean, George Bush was very bad on the whistleblower issues. I think Obama has done things, by the way, that Bush would not dare. The kill list,
right?
I don't think George Bush would have been able to get away with that. The I mean, there would be protesters in the streets. You know, the New York Times would be have an editorial every day for a year or something like that. The idea is so reprehensible. Obama does it. There's a little bit of outrage, and then it's forgotten. You know, that troubles me, of course. But the other problem troubles me a lot worse.
And so,
a lot more. Sorry, my grammar is going away here.
No, I understand. Well, that's the beauty of radio is that it just melts into the ether. We never put out a transcript, so people can't check my grammar.
My bad grammar.
And so, I mean, but in terms of an act of voting, I mean, is it? I'm just curious of your take on this. I mean, because I have argued till I'm blue in the face that I do believe in the concept of voting for the lesser of two evils, and that
you never have a choice better than that. I mean, you're never going to have a candidate. I don't care who it is. You're never going to have a candidate that you agree with all the way around. It's just never going to happen. So that's you know what the larger problem is, Sam. And we, you know, this is something that we just need to blow this subject wide open. The two-party system. It's a monopoly, sir, a duopoly. But both parties have an interest in keeping it that way. There are, you know, in the 19th century, you had lots of third-party movements. They weren't necessarily, you know, the thing that kills third parties now is, you know, it's you're throwing your vote away, or you have candidates who are a spoiler, like Ralph Nader, in the year 2000. In the 19th century, though, you had third parties that came up. The Republican Party started as a third party and knocked off one of the dominant parties of its time. My favorite political movement, the Populist Party, was a third party. There needs to be some kind of challenge to these guys. And the problem is that the two-party system, you know, in the aftermath of populism, they were like, well, we're never going to let this happen again. And they passed laws in nearly every state making the tactics that third parties used, making them illegal, you know, voting laws. And this is – it's crazy. These laws need to be repealed. We've got to have some kind of – the system just needs to be opened up. I mean, the way these the Republican Party is able to drag the debate further and further and further to the right, and then the Democratic Party with its sort of, you know, both parties, it's very easy for organized money to capture these guys. I'm sorry, I'm wandering all over the map here.
No,
but we have to have more competition in this.
And so is the answer to getting that more competition, does it in this context, does it help to vote for that third party now, or is it really more?
Well, there's no choice. It wouldn't help now. What would help is if you get there's specifically the Populist Party back in the day used a technique called fusion, where they would cross endorse. So they William Jennings Bryan, for example, was a Democratic candidate for president. The Populists endorsed him. And then they did this also at the state level. It was very effective at the state level. In Kansas, they cross-endorsed with the Democrats. In the South, they would cross-endorse with the Republicans, who were actually more, you know, more progressive at the time. In the South, that is. And they would win. using this technique, they won all the time, all over the place. And it didn't, you know, so that way you weren't throwing away your vote, and the populists weren't spoilers. And they had, you know, people getting elected from the bottom of the ticket all the way up to, you know, U.S. senators and stuff like that. We need to have that kind of option again. You have it in New York.
We
State.
Have it in
it's
New
like
York.
One of the only places where they have it.
Party.
Yeah, that's right.
That's basically what. That's basically what I subscribe to. So.
Yeah, but if we had that across the country, you would start to see much more interesting politics. And then there's this other added advantage. You know, there's whole generations of political scientists that have spent their entire careers analyzing the two-party system as though this was set in stone. But I would just love to see all that work made obsolete.
Yes. Just on a pure personal level.
Pure spite,
well,
yeah.
So if we can't convince people just for the future of the country, at least we can for...
Just in order to go after the political scientists.
Well, Thomas Frank, always a pleasure, and Pity the Billionaire, now out in paperback.
In paperback, and updated and rewritten in large part, and all sorts of great stuff added to it. Lots of new facts about Ayn Rand in there. Oh, man, it's fun.
And, hopefully you won't cause all these people to go off and live on a libertarian island and leave us without our leading lights of industrialization in this country.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you're referring to the capital strike that I'm trying to lead. Yes, right.
Indeed. I hope we don't, if all of a sudden we've got a lot of John Galt's. Going galt on us. We
don't
know who
be blaming
blame.
Me, man.
There you go. Thomas Frank, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Anytime, Sam.
Okay, bye-bye. All right, folks. And now we head to the better half of the program. The number is 646-257-3920. If you want to be a part of this program, phone lines are now open. We've now cleared all of our phone lines, and they are now open in the better half of the program. Oh, in fact, maybe they don't have to go to their own private island. Maybe they can just go down to this new libertarian paradise in Honduras. We will talk about that in the better half of the program. Also, the latest Romney tape where he talks about harvesting our organs. No, wait, I'm sorry, not our organs. Just profits from those companies that Bain Capital came in and rescued long enough to harvest their organs. I mean, their profits. Also, that story about Sheldon Adelson, the Greeks and the Spaniards, no to austerity. We could talk more about whether or not it's moral to vote for Obama. And Donald Trump emitting gas, noxious and perhaps explosive gas on New Yorkers. All this and more in the better half of the program, and you can hear the latest on my adventure to put in a solid-state drive into my computer, see if that worked. You can also IM me at Majority FM. And, folks, it is your membership that keeps this show alive. If you can become a member, please do. If you cannot afford it, we are out of StrangeAngel.com sponsored free month trials. But if you cannot afford it, sincerely cannot afford it, send us an email. We'll work something out with you at majorityreporters@gmail.com. And if you're looking to meet someone, by all means, strangeangels.com. Instead of an algorithm, you have a person who will help you out. Then you can go home, meet someone you like, take them, mix them some justcoffee.coop, coffee, tea, or chocolate. Nice gift. On the first date, maybe a second date is more appropriate. It would be a little bit weird. JustCoffee.coop, 10% coupon code majority. You can support the show in many other ways, of course. iTunes review. Like us on Facebook, I guess. Merchandise. Support the show, majority.fm/support the show. Tomorrow on the program, Cliff Schechter. What else do I got? I think that's it. We will see you in the better half of the program.